Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, a weekly conversation with the third president of the United States. The topic today is the most Jeffersonian presidents in American history. Please join us as our host Bill Kristol speaks with Thomas Jefferson, portrayed by humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced by High Plains Public Radio and New Enlightenment Radio Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the search for truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with the third president of the United States. Good day to you, Mr. Jefferson.
Good day to you, citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, a listener in Reno, Nevada, has asked a question about the most Jeffersonian president in the last 20 years, and I think we could make an entire program around this theme of Jeffersonian presidents. But first, let's answer our listener's question. Tell us who you think has been the most Jeffersonian president in the last 30 years.
In your time.
In my time.
In your time. Well, it's hard to say because you live in a Hamiltonian world and you have an urban industrial society that's highly complex and you have a system of legislation that is infinitely larger than anything that I could have envisioned, and I think that, frankly, that any of the founding fathers could have envisioned. So it's hard to believe that any of them could be Jeffersonians in the truest sense, and I don't really like the idea of the Jeffersonian anyway because it's not about my own role as a leader or as the de facto founder of the early Republican Party. It's really about the emerging democratic spirit of the American people. So I would have said in my time that a Jeffersonian, as you're calling it, is somebody who believes in limited government, who is an advocate of states' rights, who is antagonistic to taxation, who believes that education is the most important thing that any society can do, and who believes that it's our business as a nation to look inward and to create justice and maybe even a kind of paradise here and not to look abroad and have a role in the world's arena. So I'm guessing that you would be hard-pressed to nominate anyone of your time who would in any way coordinate with what I consider to be those simple natural law principles of American leadership. So we'd have to define what a Jeffersonian is.
It would be very difficult to find that constellation of characteristics in any one president in the 20th century and the beginnings of the 21st.
I think once your Civil War had occurred in the 1860s, and it was followed by the post-Civil War constitutional amendments, and chiefly the 14th, which extended the protection for rights of the national government into states and communities, I think that amounts to a constitutional revolution, and that the United States needs to see itself before and after the 14th Amendment. And before the 14th Amendment, you were, in some limited regards at least, a confederation of sovereign states. I might even say sovereign nation states.
Or at least the states may have believed themselves to be involved in a confederation.
Certainly the southern states did, and the western states. But after your Civil War, there was a very quick rush to national consolidation. So I would not have wanted to live in the post-Civil War American settlement. Most of you would not want to have lived on the other side, on the agrarian, decentralized side of the Civil War. From that point of view, from the point of view of political theory, the most Jeffersonian president of your time would be Ronald Reagan, because Ronald Reagan believed, at least in theory, in fiscal restraint, and that the duty of lovers of liberty was to pare down the size of the national government and to restore as much authority as possible to the states.
And yet Ronald Reagan increased the size of the military dramatically. This was the time of the 600-ship Navy, something that had never been before, at least since the Second World War, and certainly will never be again.
And couldn't be sustained. Apparently, that's a very expensive Navy. I regard navies as ruinous to the liberties of a people because they're floating fortresses and they rot. A Navy automatically is constantly in deterioration. It's extremely expensive to maintain a Navy, whereas an army can be dispersed back to the farms of a community during periods of peace or during the growing season. But a Navy is a perennial expense. And so I would not have made that a goal of the United States. The great Navy in the world in my time was the British Navy, and we were happy to stay within some harmony with Great Britain so that its Navy would, in a sense, protect American shipping. So, you know, as I think you're rightly pointing out, every president is going to have a mixed record on this question. But I would say of the presidents of your time, Ronald Reagan is the one who is most clearly Jeffersonian from a fiscal and constitutional theory point of view.
And I think that will come as a great surprise to most of your listeners.
Perhaps, but I must speak as a philosopher and a person who believes that the Jeffersonian impulse is going to play itself out in different leaders at different times and for different purposes. Let me give you a second example. From a stylistic point of view, the president most like myself would have been Jimmy Carter, because Carter tried to play down the imperial presidency and tried to remind the American people that the president is not a king or a dictator or an exalted figure, but really the first citizen. And if you recall, President Carter used to carry his own baggage to and from his systems of transport. He stayed with average citizens when he traveled around the country. He dressed in casual clothing and constantly adopted a folksy manner. I would not have done that, but a manner that shrank the distinction between the president and average citizens. And in that regard, that populist stylistic approach, he comes very close to my style. I rode my horse freely through Washington, D.C. I did the grocery shopping for the White House. I walked to my inauguration. I eschewed the kind of ceremonial sword that John Adams wore. I was openly derisive of Adams' belief that our national leaders should have titles of nobility and so on. I was trying to convince the American people that in a republic, the president, whatever he is not a monarch, is not a king. So there's a connection between one of your presidents, Jimmy Carter, and my own style as a president. He was also an internationalist who believed in peace. And I think in foreign policy, the Jeffersonians are those who are idealists, who believe that our duty in the foreign arena is to show the same level of virtue that we would show internally. You know, there's really two camps on this argument. There are the Hamiltonians, who believe in realpolitik, that in the international arena, self-interest and opportunism are the right values for a nation to pursue. You just do what is in the best interests of your nation from a very selfish point of view. And if you have signed a treaty of commerce and friendship with the French and it proves to be inconvenient, you break that treaty. You do whatever it takes to advance the vital interests of the nation. That's one extreme. I disagree with it profoundly. I think that it's in our interest to behave with enlightened long-term self-interest, and that we should be faithful to our friendships and our alliances. We should have as few as possible, but those we have, we should treat as sacred acts of international covenant.
Now wait, Mr. Jefferson, you speak as one who had made an agreement with the Barbary pirates, with the rulers of Morocco, in order to pay them a certain amount so that our ships could pass freely, and yet you are the one who waged war against them, who broke that treaty.
Well, I would quibble with you there. You know, as Secretary of State, I bristled under this regimen of paying bribes to these barbarians, because I thought that a show of force early on would be likely to get their respect. But I was overruled constantly by either the president or the government of the United States, the legislative branch, or the cabinet. When I became president, as I think you remember, the Pasha of Tripoli actually took out his axe and hacked down the American flag in front of the American consul building in Tripoli, and that was their way of waging war. So they declared war against us, and we had to respond in one way or the other. And I felt at that point, since they had provoked this was an unprovoked attack on American shipping, that it was finally time for us to get serious about standing up to these barbarians.
It's interesting. You have on this program indicated that you would not like a Pledge of Allegiance, and that the flag is a symbol that is not one that one ought to go to war for, and yet here you did it.
This is not because of the flag. I mean, the flag is neither here nor there in this regard, but when a foreign nation, it has a rhetoric of war and peace, and when its way of declaring war is to chop down the flagpole of another nation, that's a provocation that must be attended to. And it wasn't just about the flagpole. They were kidnapping our sailors, and they were bombarding our neutral ships in the Mediterranean
it's
waters.
Because we quit paying, as we said that we would do, right, Mr. Jefferson?
Yes, we have never signed a treaty of bribery. The bribery that you are extolling was a part of a program that in your century would have been called appeasement. And I was against it from the beginning, because I do not think you ransom innocent sailors in the long run, I think that creates conditions of degradation and disrespect. But the point that I'm making is not about that incident. I'd be happy to continue talking about it if you want. I have no doubts that we did the right thing on that score. But the argument that I'm making is that Jeffersonian presidents are international idealists, and Hamiltonian presidents are international opportunists, and I belong to the idealistic school on the whole, and so did your Jimmy Carter.
Have you been able to come up with any other idealists of the same sort?
Woodrow Wilson, who also wound up fighting a major war.
Fighting a major war, indeed, sir.
Franklin Roosevelt. There are numbers of them in American history. Mr. Madison was one of them. He was, I think, without any question, the most Jeffersonian president, including myself, was Madison. In other words, it's a paradox, but Madison was even more Jeffersonian than I was because I was a pragmatist. I'm flexible. I sometimes did things which were, strictly speaking, violations of my own principles because I am a very flexible man who has a strong streak of the utopian, but who wants to get things done in the real world.
And we're grateful because you wouldn't have purchased Louisiana if you had been
that
inflexible.
And Madison was more of an ideologue. I mean, Madison was a purer exponent of Republican theory domestically and internationally than I was. For example, my record on freedom of the press gets very high marks from historians, but not the highest marks. The highest marks for freedom of the press in American history go to James Madison. And this is true on a range of issues, that Madison was more pure in his application of what you're calling Jeffersonian political values than I was.
And he, too, was forced to be a war president, as it turns out.
And the historians, and especially the diplomatic historians, always say the same thing, that Jeffersonians are disastrous presidents from an international point of view because they allow idealism to cloud the common sense solutions that foreign entanglements require.
In our time, a number of people attempted to draw parallels between you and a president who bore, as a middle name, your name, William Jefferson Clinton. You have not mentioned him as a Jeffersonian president.
I do think there are some Jeffersonian elements to the Clinton presidency. He was an intellectual who tended to see the world through books. And that's not as much as I did, but he certainly shared a characteristic that was my central characteristic, which was that I apprehended the world, made sense of it, clarified it, and examined possibilities through books. And I think that there are presidents who are not bookish. Ronald Reagan is a perfect example of that. Your current president, I'm told, is not much of a reader either. And in your time, the presidents tend not to be readers. In my time, until Andrew Jackson, they were all readers, even Washington, although he was the least of them. But Madison, a great reader. John Adams, possibly the greatest reader in American history of the presidents. John Quincy Adams, one of the most intellectually gifted men who ever served in public office in the United States, although a New England Calvinist and prig.
Well, he was a pupil of yours, as it were, for a time.
There was a time when I helped to tutor young Quincy, and James Monroe was no intellectual, but he was a reader of books, and it was strongly imbued with Republican ideological convictions. So bookishness is one quality of a Jeffersonian, and I certainly had that, and William
Woodrow
Jefferson
Wilson
Clinton
was a professor, a greatly bookish
Jimmy
man.
Carter was a bookish man. John Kennedy was a bookish man. Ronald Reagan was not a bookish man. Richard Nixon is somewhere in the middle. Lyndon Johnson, not so much. Gerald Ford, not at all. At any rate, William Jefferson Clinton has that capacity. He also was a populist who believed that the purpose of government is to ameliorate the lives of average human beings. And I think one of the basic divides in American culture is those who attempt to improve the lives of the many, and particularly the people who are not naturally prospering, on the one hand, and the people who protect what Mr. Hamilton liked to call the wise, the rich, and the well-born, on the other. And the Hamiltonians give their enormous energies to protecting privilege and reinforcing the class system and, in some cases, lining the pockets of their cronies and themselves. And the Jeffersonians tend to be those who reach out to the mass of citizens and try to make their lives a little bit less burdensome and a little bit happier. And I think that you can certainly look at all the presidents of the second half of the 20th century and say that, for example, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was profoundly Jeffersonian, if that's what we mean by a Jeffersonian, one who looks after the little people.
And yet he was an activist when it came to government.
Which would
During the Great Depression, he created a multitude of programs that involved government in all aspects of people's lives.
And packed the courts and was four-term president and many, many violations of what I would call Jeffersonian principle. But if the argument is those who advocate the few, or rather protect the few, and those who champion the many, Franklin Roosevelt was a populist, Dwight Eisenhower not, Truman was.
Well, that brings to mind Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, he fought battles with the giants of industry and busted the trusts in this country. Wouldn't that make him Jeffersonian?
Yes, in some regards. He was a patrician, like myself. He was a, I suppose you would say that he and I had the same noblesse oblige. That is, we were gentry. We were born privileged, but we gave our lives largely to the furtherance of democratic principles. And so when that happens, the Hamiltonians frequently see men like Roosevelt and myself as having betrayed their class. Sometimes they accuse us of being demagogues for giving our energies to the common people when we are anything but common by way of birth. And I think both Roosevelt and myself were what I would call pseudo-aristocrats who worked all of their lives to become natural aristocrats. Roosevelt is probably the writingest president. He's one of the towering intellectuals of your presidents. He was a vigorous man who, like myself, loved horse culture and the out-of-doors. He was enamored of trees, as I was. He virtually had a love affair with trees and became the greatest champion of the public forests in American history.
The national park system.
And I was a tree lover, and I was one of the advocates of a national park system, although in a very early phase. But when I bought the Natural Bridge in Virginia, I was doing so to protect it from what you would call development, to preserve it as a piece of the sublime. And so that's seen by some historians as the seed of the National Park Preservation Movement in American history. I love trees so much that Margaret Bayard Smith, who was a woman who was my friend and who flirted with me while I was president, she was the wife of my dear friend who was the editor of the National Intelligencer. And Margaret Bayard Smith recorded in her table talk of my presidency that I once said that cutting down a tree unnecessarily should be considered a felony, and that as few trees should be cut down in American history as was absolutely necessary, and that in a sense cutting down a tree is murder. And so I shared with Theodore Roosevelt that deep, I mean, almost an enamorment with the tree, which I think is probably a relatively rare quality in American presidents. I believe President Reagan actually said once that trees are polluters because they release carbon dioxide and use up oxygen. So he was wrong scientifically. And
I was
going to
say, I thought in terms of photosynthesis, they restored oxygen.
That would be my reading too, but I'm told that he was not a scientist, whatever else he was. But at any rate, Theodore Roosevelt was an intellectual. He differed from me in many important ways, however. He was a very strong president. The most recent biography of Theodore Roosevelt is called Theodore Rex, which is, of course, a term for king. Rex is Latin for king. And he was a high-toned, strong man, virtually a dictator in some regards. He was also fond of war, and I find that appalling, frankly, in an American statesman. He also disliked me intensely, but I hope that my sensitivity to the ad hominem insults that he leveled at me at every turn does not color my analysis of him, but he did say that I was the most effeminate of all presidents.
I think to some degree, Roosevelt may have been the most Jeffersonian of presidents in the 20th century. Extracting the strong virility and military inclination, I think certainly you would have admired his aphorism, speak softly and carry a big stick. I think you deem that the United States should be a nation that didn't involve itself in foreign entanglements, but when it was forced to do so, would react decisively.
I'm not sure that I would agree with his aphorism, but I certainly think speak softly and try to find the mild path before you are forced upon the more aggressive one.
Mr. Jefferson, we've got to take a short break, but let's mine some of the insights that you have brought forward in the second part of our program regarding Jeffersonian presidents.
You have been listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Please visit our website, www.th-jefferson.org. On our website, you will find a place to ask Mr. Jefferson your question. Many of our programs, including today's program, came from listener questions. Thank you and stay tuned. We will be back in just a moment.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with the third president. In our first segment, we have been talking about Jeffersonian presidents, concentrating mainly on the 20th century. But Mr. Jefferson, in the 19th century, you suggested that Madison would be the most Jeffersonian of presidents. Are there any others that might win that accolade?
Monroe. I mean, I have to say, these were my hand-picked successors.
Protégés.
So I would talk that way, I'm sure, but I've already praised Madison. I considered Madison one of the great men in world history. And I had the deepest respect for him. And he was, frankly, a deeper thinker than I was. And he was a more systematic thinker than I was. And he was a more politically astute man than I was. And he had more political stamina than I did. You know, I get lots of praise in the course of American history for my achievements. And there were many, of course. But, you know, my achievements would have been decidedly diminished had it not been for Madison. Madison had political stamina and I didn't. I was what I suppose you call an amateur or a Renaissance man or perhaps even a dilettante, and I was willing to flit from library classification to my edition of the New Testament to working with peach trees at Monticello to tearing down a portion of the walls to build it in a new way to studying ancient Greek, to buying horses and trying to decide what the best possible horse flesh was for a climate like Virginia, or experimenting with a hemp machine. I mean, my range was so great and my curiosity was so deep and my interest in politics so little, really, that I was not a tenacious political figure like some others of my time. And I get much more credit than I really deserve. And, you know, Madison was the founder of the Republican Party, not your Republican Party, but the first Republican Party. And I was really just the figurehead.
I know this is going to strike you as anathema, but it would seem that when it comes to populism, Andrew Jackson struck a very Jeffersonian note. Now, I know you didn't like him. You thought him a ruffian, but
well, I had good reason for that. But yes, you're right. Jackson was Jackson's actual political positions and principles and decisions were as close to mine as that of those of any other president. You know, if you only took our actual decisions and the principles which were the foundation of them, we are closer, I think, than any two American presidents. And he believed in the West. He was an agrarian. He believed in limited government. He advocated states' rights. He was suspicious of banks. He was an isolationist in foreign policy. I mean, he pursued my Indian policies, although I think he vulgarized them to a certain extent. But I would have a hard time making a serious distinction between myself and Andrew Jackson in terms of policy or philosophy. He was more truly democratic than I was. I'm a patrician, so my political life was characterized by noblesse oblige. He was much more of a true commoner. He was a dualist. He was barely literate. And the things that bothered me about him were his propensity for battle, both personal battle and national battle. And the way he went after the Seminole Indians in Florida, I thought was barbaric. But I'm sure you know the story of his inauguration when his pals from the rough frontier of Kentucky and Tennessee, came to Washington to see the great man installed, and they virtually rioted in the White House. They stood on the sofas with their muddy boots and manure all over, and they broke windows and pulled down the draperies and stole things and shattered priceless objects. This was the triumph of populism in a way that I don't find attractive at all.
The ugly side of democracy, Mr. Jefferson.
Well, I don't call that democracy. I call that barbarism. I don't think democracy requires the breaking of anything. But I take your point. It was a commoner's triumph, and the commoners, I'm fond of the common people because I believe that they have an inherent legitimacy as the sovereign, and I believe that their natural exuberance is a corrective against corruption and abuse and privilege. And I like a little rebellion now and then. I just wish they wouldn't trash the White House.
It's interesting, though. I think Mr. Jackson really was comfortable among the common people. You yourself would never have been. You had great respect for them.
In theory.
In theory, but in actual fact, you would have withdrawn from them.
Well, I certainly would have been more graceful, and I would have policed the White House a little bit more carefully, and I would have suggested some protocol during my inauguration. I think Jackson let that go. I mean, the same people loved me who loved Jackson. I mean, I was the first people's president, and some of the banners that circulated in my contests with John Adams were Jefferson, man of the people, and when I was elected in 1800, there was a paroxysm of joy that this man who loved the people had been elected. Now, I was about as aloof as it is possible to be, but if I had, and I had open houses where the people were allowed, of course, welcome to come into the White House, but there was a sense of decorum that I radiated about me that Jackson did not. I mean, here was a man who had killed people in duels, and he had a fiery temper. I was angry only two or three times in the whole course of my life, and he swore like a sailor, and, you know, he had qualities that I find admirable enough in the people, but wholly out of keeping with a leader.
Be that as it may, Mr. Jefferson, it seems to me the Jeffersonian Revolution, which you suggest reached its apex with Mr. Madison, may have been only going to the next logical step with Mr. Jackson.
Yes, I certainly take your point. But I do want to stress, because I feel that this is a critical issue, that in a republic there needs to be a high level of civility. That decorum, gracefulness, politeness, civility, forbearance, tolerance, these are all extremely important qualities. And we cannot be a republic if we're a collection of vulgarians. So I do have just a fundamental difference with Jackson. I think that one nurtures the best qualities in the people, but when you indulge it and when you cheer it from the sidelines, the people will frequently misbehave. And whenever you add alcohol, and I don't want to sound like John Adams or some New Englander, but alcohol is a terrible poison that has ruined fortunes. And I saw dinner parties all over Virginia amongst the gentry that would end in the worst sort of barbarism and drunkenness and depravity. Alcohol in large quantities, I think all grain alcohol, all distilled spirits, are a poor thing for a republic. I hope that wine would be the drink of a republic. I'm doubting that Andrew Jackson drank much wine, and I'm sure his wine tastes were deplorable.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I know you don't particularly want to be compared.
He came to Poplar Forest with blood on his hands in 1815 after the Battle of New Orleans, and he passed through, and I was there on one of my visits to my second property down in Bedford, and some runner came up and said that General Jackson was in the vicinity, and I felt I had no choice but to entertain him at dinner. And he came, and he was just a bloody mess. You know, it was not a pleasant event for me. I'm surprised I didn't tear the draperies down at Poplar Forest.
We really don't want to go into this room. I understand that Jackson, as a young man, was being whipped by British soldiers during the Revolution when you were being accused of having fled into the woods.
Perhaps you'd like to move on.
Interesting subject, Jeffersonian presidents.
Madison, Monroe, even John Quincy Adams.
Oh, now this surprises me. John Quincy Adams was Jeffersonian?
You know, I'll tell you why. John Quincy Adams was an enormously gifted intellectual who was a cosmopolitan. You know, he had been in St. Petersburg. He had been in Prussia. He had been in France. He had been in the Low Countries. He knew many European languages. He was a man of letters. He was a very deep student of political theory. He was a man who, you know, he really came over to my political party in many respects. John Adams did first, but John Adams was always skeptical. But during the embargo of 1807, John Quincy Adams was one of my staunchest supporters. When the Louisiana Treaty was being decried in 1803 by the partisan Federalists, John Quincy Adams said, no, this is in the interests of the United States. When I was willing to cut and run on the treaty and allow the northern border to be from the putative source of the Mississippi River West, Adams held up that provision in the Senate of the United States and said, no, we need to think more clearly about that before we settle the northern boundary of the United States. And when he became the Secretary of State of my protege, James Monroe, he negotiated the final treaty settlement that gave the United States a much more significant piece of what's now Canada than we would have had under the provisions of the original Louisiana Treaty. He got us the Floridas in 1818. John Quincy Adams was an ardent believer in geopolitical necessities as we developed the borders of the country at a time when virtually everybody of both parties just saw the West as infinite land. John Quincy Adams thought of it in terms of rivers, watersheds, borders, defensible borders, buffer zones between us and the Spanish, buffer zones between us and the British. This was a genius. Now, I did not like John Quincy Adams, and I wish he hadn't written those squibs about Sally Hemings and other. He wrote a nasty assault on Meriwether Lewis, and he was a satirist, and he had a, you know, he was not even as graceful as his father, but he was a great intellectual, and I admire his capacity for political flexibility.
And I think one of the things that strikes me as a modest student of history about John Quincy Adams is the realization that after having been president, he went into the Congress and served for more than 30 years as a congressman.
He collapsed on the floor.
Extraordinary thing that he would see service to this country in such a light that he continued to do it for the rest of his life.
I don't think there are many presidents who would take that stepping down from the pinnacles of glory into some lesser seat. And the House of Representatives was seen as a fairly low club of political functionaries, but he was an abolitionist, and he was an abolitionist that I respect because he had a deep conviction and he acted upon his conviction and he wasn't righteous about it. He really just wanted to repair the terrible stain of slavery in this country. So I have regard for him. The problem is I just don't like him, and like all Adams, he couldn't stand to be liked by the people, and so he was a one-term president.
Well, I think the Adams may have had this sense that in doing what is necessary, one need not worry about popularity.
Well, yes, but to court unpopularity as a sign of personal virtue is, I think, merely perverse. You know that John Adams had this quality, and his son did to a certain degree. But I congratulated John Adams when his son was elected president, even though I had been pushing for Crawford, who was the other guy.
With all that you've had to say about John Quincy now, you tell us that you were in favor of his opponent?
Well, because the opponent was a Southerner, and you know, the opponent hadn't written poetry about Sally Hemings.
Well, you must remember, I think, Mr. Jefferson, that the only slave who ever spent time in the Adams household, this being the household of John and Abigail, was Sally Hemings.
Touché, you're absolutely right. That may not be true absolutely, but it is certainly true that in Europe, the slave that the Adams had the primary relationship with was young Sally Hemings, who, to everybody's surprise, including, may I say, my own, came as the chaperone to my daughter Polly when I fetched her. You know, I wanted Polly to come to Europe to be with me after my daughter Lucy died of whooping cough, and I said I wanted Polly to be chaperoned by an elderly black woman who had had the smallpox. And instead they sent this 14-year-old girl, Sally Hemings, as the chaperone to Maria, to Polly, and they stopped at London first, and I couldn't get there. I was busy with diplomatic affairs in Paris, and so I sent my maitre d' to fetch her, and so Maria stayed with the Adams family for a couple of weeks, and Abigail, in a sense, fell in love with her and thought she was the most charming young girl that she had ever met.
I think their affinity for one another lasted for lifetimes.
It did until, the death of my daughter in April of 1804, when Abigail broke a long and bitter political silence to send me a letter of condolence. But Sally was with Polly when they arrived in London, and Abigail, with her New England sharpness, said, "It's not clear who's the chaperone here," and said, "You'd better just send Miss Hemmings back to the United States as quickly as possible for the good of everybody." And so she may have anticipated that this was the wrong sort of temptation to put in front of a grieving widower on foreign soil.
Indeed, Mr. Jefferson. We're talking about Jeffersonian presidents, though, and we've looked at the early part of the 19th century. Let's look at the latter part of the 19th century. Indeed, this was a difficult time after the American Civil War, which you indeed, among others, predicted. But could you find among any of those presidencies anyone who was Jeffersonian? Like Rutherford B. Hayes, would you see him as Jeffersonian in any respect?
No. I would say that after the death of Abraham Lincoln and until the rise of Theodore Roosevelt or possibly McKinley, that it was a sea of mediocrity. And, you know, I would challenge any of your listeners to even name the presidents of that period. They're so pathetic. They were corrupt, like Ulysses S. Grant. They were men of conflict of interest. They were political hacks for the most part. They weren't well educated, although I believe that Chester Arthur knew Greek as well as I did, or as well as John Adams did. And I also believe that it's the case that Chester Arthur could write simultaneously with both hands. You have to like that. I admire that. I would have liked to have learned that trick. I was ambidextrous, but not simultaneously. So, but for the most part, and let me just say, in many regards, Abraham Lincoln is the least Jeffersonian president in American history, holding the Union together with an army. What sort of a constitutional theory is that?
Bleeding the common people of the land to keep this Union together.
600-some thousand of them died for a civil war that should have been avoided. I think the correct response of any president would be to say to South Carolina, "Fare thee well. You are a commonwealth. Align yourself in any way you please, and when you are within your natural rights to secede, and we wish you well, we will help you if we can. But if you choose to come back, and we know you will, there will be conditions, and one of them will be that you cannot come back as a slaveholding state." But let me just say for the record, I do not accept national intrusion into state sovereignty on questions of slavery. I believe in states' rights. I believe in nullification under certain conditions. I don't think that it's the business of Washington whether South Carolina has slaves. I think it can be a condition for a reentry, but I do not believe that it was constitutionally just for the 16th President Abraham Lincoln to behave as he did. I think he fully misunderstood the Constitution, which is a voluntary compact of sovereign constituent states. And if any one of those states wants to leave the Union for any purpose whatsoever, it has a natural right to do so, just as we had the right to leave the British Empire in 1776. So I find it perplexing to think that this man could be so thin-skinned about Union that he would send armies to protect it.
Well, all of this is...
I like his Homestead Act. I think that's a very good idea.
All of this is of no consequence following the Civil War and the addition of certain other amendments. I mean, the federal government is indeed the last word, Mr.
Jefferson. The 14th Amendment was, in my opinion, the death blow to the Constitution of the United States.
Jeffersonian presidents. Let's look at this list. We have Monroe. We have Madison. We can even include perhaps John Quincy Adams. No one, virtually, until the 20th century.
Well, Harrison and Tyler. I mean, some of those early presidents before the Civil War,
okay.
I would give them.
But mediocrity, the sort of mediocrity you were talking about after the Civil War. 20th century, you will allow Teddy Roosevelt?
Yes, although I think his testosterone was way out of keeping with human dignity.
Well, he was a leader in battle, Mr. Jefferson, and you're not really able to relate to people.
I think anyone who says bully... is unfitted for high office.
Mr. Jefferson, we're going to have to take another break, and when we return, Clay Jenkinson will be here to discuss in further detail Jeffersonian presidencies. But we thank you for this attempt to get out of your own time. And
my
to,
delight, sir.
And to let us know who's who. Good day.
You have been listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Please visit our website, www.th-jefferson.org. www.th-jefferson.org.
Welcome back from that break. I'm Clay Jenkinson, the Thomas Jefferson Scholar. Seated across from me is my dear friend, Bill Crystal, the amanuensis of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Bill, welcome. You know, among other things, you're working on John Adams, and I travel around the country, and people are saying, when can we expect Adams to emerge in full dress? So what? Give us a sense of when you think that...
With sword.
With sword, you have ceremonial sword and title, his rotundity. When will Adams be ready for public consumption?
I don't know. He'll be ready when he has his first
gig.
First gig.
Bill, you know, this has been a very intriguing discussion. Who are the Jeffersonians?
And
I think, you know, we started right off by saying it depends on how you ask the question, because there are Jeffersonians in foreign policy. There are Jeffersonians in their basic democratic outlook. There are Jeffersonians who believe in limited government. There are fiscal Jeffersonians. Jefferson is, in many respects, a libertarian. Are there any candidates except the libertarians that we would put into that camp in our own time? So it's really a hard question, because the country has changed so much that it's not clear that if somebody tried to be a Jeffersonian, there could be the slightest chance of that person advancing very far in our system. But I think we get the point, and I've tried to link us to the ones I consider as a Jefferson scholar as likely to have pleased Thomas Jefferson in one respect or another. Well, let's turn to John Adams for a moment. I mean, John Adams is sui generis. He's his own entity. I doubt that there are many Adamsian presidents in American history.
I think here again it would come down to certain characteristics being more Adamsian than others. At one point he thought that if he had an epitaph, it ought to read that he avoided war during his presidency.
So who's done that? Who's taken the extra step?
I thought Jimmy Carter at one point was noble in that he avoided war with Iran, although one morning I awoke to see all these burning
the helicopters.
Burning military.
But that was a rescue mission. Yeah. That was not war.
But I think that those presidents who've attempted to avoid war...
Well, John Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Although Kennedy, in a sense, avoided war by taking us to the brink of war.
But it is an amazing story. I've just been reading a new biography of him by Robert Dalek. I think it's JFK, The Unfinished Presidency. And it is one of the most exciting moments in American history. How close we came to a nuclear exchange. And how the warlords, the Defense Department people, were pushing for a more stern response. And Kennedy said no. Of the options, we're going to try the one that's this side of exchange.
Sometimes I think it's good that presidents have been in the military, because I think
they may know
how to relate to the generals. Sometimes I fear that those who are the least effective are those who don't have that experience. I rue in our own day that there are fewer and fewer who have that experience.
Well, thank goodness George W. Bush was in the Texas Air National Guard, and so he's had his time in the armed services of the United States. I think we can all sleep a little more happily over that.
Oh, Clay, please don't take us down this road.
Dwight D. Eisenhower, you know, one of the great military leaders in American history, has annoyed many with his farewell address, which
warned
would beware
us against military-industrial complex.
And my goodness, do we have it now. I mean, if ever there was a military-industrial complex, we have found it in large measure. But Adams, avoiding war. So Kennedy did, Carter did.
I think Woodrow Wilson tried for a long time, and as best he could, to keep us out of the European
FDR?
War. FDR maintained neutrality, but at the same time was arming the Brits. I think FDR understood that we would be involved sooner or later.
Who would Adams like in terms of style?
Oh, goodness. Probably Calvin Coolidge and his fellow New Englander.
That's a sad commentary.
No, I don't know that
Polk,
he would.
You know what, he might admire Polk, because I don't know much about Polk. I'm not a presidential historian, but Polk said, I'm going to come to power and we're going to take Mexico. He came to power and he took Mexico and he quit. One term. He did what he said he was going to do. He made no bones about it. He did it really well, and then he retired.
I honestly think Adams was, in Hegelian historical analysis.
What do you mean by Hegelian?
Well, Hegel, the great historian.
Right. I got you so far.
Talks about the synthesis and then the antithesis.
Okay, so the kind of pendulum.
Or the thesis, the antithesis, and then the synthesis. I think it was John Adams' fate as a president to be the antithesis.
We have
George
everybody.
Washington, the synthesis. We have John Adams, the antithesis. And then I think
Jefferson
afterward,
the synthesis.
I think the presidency begins to synthesize. So I think it was John Adams' fate, really, unfortunately, and to some degree, to define in negative terms what the presidency would become.
You know, one of the meanest things that Jefferson ever said was about John Adams. He saved a bunch of them of his more illiberal moments for Adams. And when Jefferson lost the election of 1796, he said, good, because Adams has to follow Washington. And many of Washington's policies are now coming back to haunt us, and Adams will be left holding the bag. Who wants to follow Washington? What could be a worse fate for any president than to have to follow the most respected, most popular, most revered president in American history?
Well, I think an ideal choice is someone who doesn't ever believe that he can be popular.
Well, George Herbert Walker Bush had to follow one of the most popular presidents in American history. Harry Truman had to follow one of the most popular presidents in American history. This can't be easy for these gentlemen.
No, I do think in Adams' case, he was a great communicator, but he never really succeeded in communicating. He wrote too much, and perhaps at times he was his own worst enemy. And I think during the presidency, there is a lot to suggest that that might have been the case. But I honestly believe the Hegelian view of history was happening, that the Washington represented the beginning, that Adams may have represented something at another place, and that, as you suggest, Jefferson may have been the synthesis, the beginning of synthesis.
But Adams disliked Jefferson's popularity because he assumed that it must be demagogic, that Jefferson couldn't really mean it when he said all those nice things about the people.
Well, I think Adams knew Jefferson and knew that Jefferson never spent much time around the people, that he was personally a withdrawn human being. Adams was much more a man of the people. And when Jefferson would talk about being from the people and from the soil, Adams knew that Jefferson had, his soil was tilled by slaves, whereas in the case of Adams, the family was running the farm there in Braintree. So I think Adams probably saw that Jefferson was being accorded a lot of things that probably fit better John Adams, who was never given credit for any of those virtues.
Another way to look at this program today is which presidents thought of themselves as Jeffersonians rather than which would Jefferson approve of.
Well, I think Bill Clinton would be really disappointed.
He's right up there. He's right up there. And you can tell by the artwork, because every president changes the Oval Office artwork. And when Clinton became president, he took down the portrait, I can't remember whether it was T.R. or Herbert Hoover, and put up Jefferson's portrait in the Oval Office. And William Jefferson Clinton clearly saw himself as the heir of Thomas Jefferson. And I think rightly, in that intellectuals, believers in reform.
There was nothing patrician about Bill Clinton, though.
No, he was sort of a trailer sort of guy. He's with Jackson. He's tearing down the curtains. But I do think that he had Jeffersonian impulses as president, especially his bookishness. And Carter thought of himself as a Jeffersonian. I suppose Democrats are much more likely to do this than Republicans.
Actually, I think Carter was more Jeffersonian than any I can think of. In the minds of many, he was something of a bottleneck because he needed to be there to make all of the decisions. That's very Jeffersonian. Thomas Jefferson didn't like to delegate. He liked to be at the center of things.
That's true, but in a way you could say that Jimmy Carter was an Adamsite, because he told the truth even when he knew that it would be unpopular. And he was willing to sort of preach at us about what was wrong with us. And he sort of prided himself on being alone, that somehow he was going to earn our trust, but then he was going to ask us to trust him on the great questions of the day, on the malaise of America and on his anti-Soviet work and so on.
Of course, when you have a brother like Billy, you know that there's a certain counterbalance that goes on.
No such creature in John Adams' life. Well, it's a very interesting subject. Herbert Croly, I've quoted before, but he wrote a book in 1909 called The Promise of American Life, in which he said you can only now be a Jeffersonian if you adopt Hamiltonian means. So the crisis of the 20th century is that all Jeffersonians have to be Hamiltonians too.
So who does Clay Jenkinson think is the most Jeffersonian of the presidents?
Most Jeffersonian of the presidents. Well, I started by, as Jefferson, saying what I think true is that Madison is more Jeffersonian than Jefferson. But if we're talking about the presidents of my lifetime, and I was born in 1955, certainly not Eisenhower. Kennedy, yes, in many regards, although we've become so disillusioned about John Kennedy for many different reasons that really the only reason that he's a Jeffersonian is that he was a man of great elegance and mental capacity.
Now, you were hard on Lyndon Johnson, but the Great Society was such a Jeffersonian program, at least in theory.
I don't think Jefferson would have pulled his dog's ears and shown his scars on national television. But I do think
he
Johnson
might have pretended to be a war hero if there'd been anything to attach itself to.
He actually did. There's a very interesting chapter in Robert Caro's book about Lyndon Johnson's World War II.
That's what I mean. He pretended to
fly sorties when he was just flying as a congressman. But Johnson, yes, to a certain degree. I think Nixon, absolutely not, of course. Gerald Ford, not. Carter, yes. I think Carter may be the most Jeffersonian president of our time. Reagan, I think Reagan has actually, I know I'm sure some of our listeners were appalled to hear me say as Jefferson that he would nominate Reagan, but I think it's true. Reagan really did believe in devolution, that the states should become more important, that we should have fiscal conservatism, that that the government should be pared down, the government was an evil. I believe that Reagan trusted the people and believed in the people and had I think Reagan is a very mixed president, and I would not rank him very high as president in my own scale as an amateur historian, but I do believe he was a Jeffersonian in some really important regards. George Bush Sr., an internationalist like Jefferson. I wouldn't go much farther than that with him, but a man of gracefulness and a patrician. I think there some of that connects him to Jefferson. Bill Clinton, he's a very strange mix, isn't he? I have the deepest admiration for Clinton's mind. When George W. Bush was running and couldn't answer simple questions like who's the prime minister of this or that, the New Yorker ran an article about this, and they picked like 10 or 15 questions, Sri Lanka and Indonesia and African nations and gross domestic products and so on, and they put them to internationalists, including some very important ones like Kissinger and others, and they all scored moderately well. And then at the end of this article in the New Yorker, they said, who's the only person in America who would have gotten 100%? And it was Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton was, by all accounts, one of the most masterfully informed, intelligent, analytically gifted presidents in American history. One of the deepest readers, somebody who really thought about things, somebody who had a vision. But after that, after you get to that, all that praise, then it breaks down pretty quickly. And that's, I think, a tragedy.
His midnight pardons certainly wouldn't have pleased Thomas Jefferson, that's for sure.
The pardons, the lack of political will, the compromising, the desperation in Clinton's thirst for popularity, not to mention, his finances and his sexual activities.
I have the question of the hour for you, though, Clay. Were Thomas Jefferson alive today, would he play golf? Every president of the United States does.
And there's a new book on this subject, which I think shows
you're
the nadir
kidding.
Of our times. No, it's about presidential golf. Would Jefferson play golf? Absolutely not. I mean, I think Jefferson would regard golf. Well, Samuel Johnson said of hunting, it is a monument to the poverty of the human imagination that it can include hunting as one of its diversions. I think Jefferson would say golf is one of the most banal human constructs. Because it's endlessly time-consuming and pointless. And to think that many of our most important decisions are made on the golf links, I think would frighten Jefferson. He's a scribbler. He'd be home writing letters.
We have a question from a listener in Norfolk. Do we know what Thomas Jefferson's voice sounded like?
Well, not like mine and not like yours. You know, I make no attempt to sound like Jefferson because, I can't. I'm not an actor.
He was a poor public speaker.
He had a stammer of some sort. I sometimes, when I talk, try to have a little catch in my voice, a little hesitancy to try to I'm doing it now, you know, to try to show that diffidence. I
thought you were thinking on your feet.
Well, that's the theory, isn't it? He had a high-pitched voice. It was certainly not a Midwestern voice like mine. I have a kind of a colorless and odorless Midwestern.
You speak general American, as they say.
I don't speak like a North Dakotan, I can tell you that, although I am
one. Don't you know?
My mother and sister do, though, and they're thrilling. Whenever I call up, I feel like I've just been time-warped into the film Fargo.
You betcha.
But Jefferson had a high-pitched voice, a weak and reedy voice. It would undoubtedly have had some Southern accent in it, maybe some Scottish. All of his tutors were Scottish, probably British. I had a college professor at the University of Minnesota named Robert Moore from North Carolina, and he had the most beautiful gentleman's North Carolina accent with a very light Southern accent, but it was clearly touched by the British accent, and it was sort of beautifully graceful and gentle and slightly effeminate, but not in any way that was off-putting. And I've always, I may be wrong about this, but I've always assumed that's how Jefferson sounded. It was a, if you think of an upper class, upper South, very gentle patrician's voice.
Not as Southern as Shelby Foote and Ken Burns.
No, none of that drawling. I can't imagine Jefferson talking that way. But I can imagine Jefferson having a Southern lilt, a little Southern lilt to his voice. But who knows? You know, we don't know. I think I've been studying Theodore Roosevelt lately, and I'm really enamored of Roosevelt. And Roosevelt, I think, was the first president to be audio recorded.
By Thomas Edison.
But we don't have U.S. Grant, and we don't have Abraham Lincoln, and we don't have Andrew Jackson, and we don't have Thomas Jefferson. So we have to rely on very tiny pieces of evidence, and they're not very useful.
It's interesting. I think people would not get into the presidency nowadays because of their voices, but we'll save this for another program.
Bill, it's been a pleasure. We're so glad you're doing John Adams. We'll see everybody next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Stay tuned.
Good day.
Music for the Thomas Jefferson Hour was provided by Stephen Swinford of Reno, Nevada. You can visit Mr. Jefferson's homepage on the World Wide Web at www.th-jefferson.org. www.th-jefferson.org. To ask Mr. Jefferson a question or to donate $9 and receive a copy of today's program on CD or cassette, please call 1-888-458-1803. 1-888-458-1803. Thank you for listening, and we hope you join us again next week for another entertaining, historically accurate, and thought-provoking commentary through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced by High Plains Public Radio and New Enlightenment Radio Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the search for truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson.